President Donald Trump is enjoying the long holiday weekend at his private club in Palm Beach, Florida. There was some golf, but he's working as well, meeting with the men who could replace retired General Michael Flynn as National Security Advisor. On Saturday, the president attended a rally organized and paid for by his campaign. Joining us now is NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Hi, Tam.
Hey.
So I want to start with comments the president made during that weekend rally. The president was talking about the state of the world and arguing for increased security and stronger borders. Let's listen.
You look at what's happening in Germany. You look at what's happening last night in Sweden. Sweden. Who would believe this? Sweden. They took in large numbers. They're having problems like they never thought possible. You look at what's happening in Brussels. You look at what's happening all over the world. Take a look at Nice. Take a look at Paris.
But, Tamara, nothing terror-related happened in Sweden over the weekend. How have the president's remarks been received?
That's right. Nothing terror-related happened. Apparently, there there were some pop culture happenings in Sweden over the weekend, but nothing terror-related at all. So the reaction has been something of a mix of concern and puzzlement coming out of Sweden. The president has since clarified. He's tweeted a couple of times. He tweeted yesterday saying, "My statement as to what's happening in Sweden was in reference to a story that was broadcast on Fox News concerning immigrants and Sweden." And then this morning, he tweeted again about that, providing, I guess, further clarity he felt he needed. "Give the public a break. The fake news media is trying to say that large-scale immigration in Sweden is working out just beautifully. Not." So it seems that the president, as he often does, was watching Fox News, saw something, and just sort of incorporated it into his remarks. And it took sort of a day of sleuthing of people wondering what the heck he was talking about.
And what about the concept of holding this kind of campaign-style rally at all? I mean, how unusual is it for a president to be giving a speech like this in this fashion just a month after getting inaugurated?
You know what? It would seem to be unusual until you go back and look at history. And it turns out the only thing truly unusual about this event is that his campaign paid for it and that it was organized by the campaign. Ordinarily, presidents will go out, they will hold events that look very much like campaign events, and they just won't call them campaign events. And so I was looking back in recent history, you know, Bill Clinton, who really was carried into office on these televised town halls that he did in 1992. Well, 3 weeks into his presidency, he holds a televised town hall and says he sort of missed it and he wanted to get back in touch with the people. Presidents have a tendency to repeat what got them into office. The challenge, though, is that governing is not campaigning. President Trump over the weekend said something to the effect of, "Life is a campaign." Actually, governing is different than campaigning, and some of these past presidents have found that it, you know, their persuasive powers don't work as well when they're trying to push policy as when they are just trying to win.
You mentioned the president's tweet on fake news. The president has continued to attack the news media. He tweeted on Friday that the mainstream media was, quote, "the enemy of the American people." Senator John McCain responded to that on NBC's Meet the Press this weekend.
"If you want to preserve democracy as we know it, you have to have a free and many times adversarial press. And without it, I'm afraid that we would lose so much of our individual liberties over time. That's how dictators get started."
Tamara, White House administrations always tussle with the news media, but this feels different, is it?
You know, Steve Bannon, the advisor, top advisor to President Trump, has called the media the opposition party. That's not actually the role of the media. But, you know, President Trump he needs a foil. As a candidate, he had lots of foils, including John McCain and Hillary Clinton and Democrats. Well, now he has a Republican Congress and the Democrat. He doesn't have Hillary Clinton to kick around anymore. And he needs a foil. He needs somebody to be in a fight with. And he has chosen the media.
And lastly, in about the 30 seconds we have left, where are we in Trump's search for a new national security advisor?
Right. He is meeting this weekend, apparently not actually playing that much golf, instead meeting with possible replacements for Mike Flynn, including former U.N. Ambassador John Bolton, Keith Kellogg, who's the acting national security advisor, Lieutenant General Robert Caslin, who is the head of the military academy at West Point, and Army strategist Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster. He met with all of them apparently yesterday and continues to hold meetings trying to settle on someone and also get someone to say yes, because he's had a couple of top candidates who've dropped out.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Thanks, Tam.
You're welcome.
Well, while the president's been in Florida, his sons, Eric and Don Jr., spent the weekend in Dubai for the opening of a Trump-branded golf club. The Trump sons have taken over management of the Trump Organization, even though President Trump still owns the company. And that continued ownership has raised some questions. Here to talk about that is Marilyn Giewax, NPR Senior Business Editor. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Jeremy.
So first, this golf course has been in the works for a while, but the president has promised that there would be no new foreign deals for his company while he's president. What about that?
Well, that's the kind of reason that we created this ethics monitor, because he says some things and then you're not sure, did he stick to that? So we really have gone over everything very carefully. And yes, we have the direct quote where they said no new foreign deals. But then we look at the evidence of, is he sticking with that? And there's this Dubai golf course. It was started in 2013, but the grand opening has just, you know, been happening. But it's going on from there. And now they're also going to build another course. They're adding villas. So do you only look at the part that was promised in 2013, or do you look at the new things that have yet to be built? And that's happening also in Scotland. There's a Trump golf course where he's also going to be adding a great deal there. There's deals in Indonesia. There's a new one, it looks like, that's popping up in the Dominican Republic. So some of these things might have been a twinkle in their eye at one point, but they really weren't done deals, and now they're happening. So whether or not you see that as a new deal, it's kind of on that line where it depends on how you want to look at it.
Well, in either way, it's a deal that is connected to the current president of the United States, at least in some way.
Correct, because although he has shifted daily management to his sons, he continues to own the Trump Organization. The profits still go to the president.
So he also said in November on NBC that he doesn't think it's appropriate for him to own stocks when he's making deals for the country. A spokesman said that he sold all his shares in companies in June. Is that true?
That's on our ethics monitor. We can say he promised to sell the stocks. He said he has done it, but we have no evidence. He has not presented any kind of receipts or any way of showing that it really happened. And, you know, he's had a bit of a history here where he says he's going to do one thing, and then when the press follows up, it turns out it wasn't really done. So we're pushing for that evidence. We'd love to see that he has sold them. We don't have that evidence yet.
And what about what he said about his salary? Right after the election, then-President-elect Trump told Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes that he would take a $1 salary. Let's listen.
Are you going to take the salary, the president's salary?
Well, I've never commented on this, but the answer is no. I think I have to, by law, take $1. So I'll take $1 a year. But it's a, I don't even know what it is. Do you know what the salary is?
$400,000.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to take the salary. I'm not taking it.
So, Marilyn, has he followed through on that? And is he taking a $1 a year salary?
Well, actually, the law says that he has to take the $400,000 that the taxpayers owe the president. But he could keep $1 and give $399,000, you know, whatever, give it back to the Treasury. So is he going to donate it back to the Treasury? Again, we've seen no evidence that he has set up any mechanism for returning that money to the Treasury. So at this point, all we know is that the law says he must be cut a paycheck. We don't know if he's returning it.
So any other promises that he made that you're watching at this point?
Well, sort of this big one is the tax returns. He has said that he would release his tax returns when an audit is done. We found no evidence that an audit is being done. I mean, you don't have to see the tax returns themselves. He could release to us a letter or documentation from the IRS that an audit is in progress. There's no such evidence. There are no such tax returns. It's not at all clear what the timeline is. So we may never get these tax returns. And, you know, that's something that presidents have always done in the modern era, is show people what they own so that we understand where the conflicts of interest might be. In this case, we don't even know that there's an audit, let alone have the tax returns.
And I remember Kellyanne Conway, the president's counselor, coming out shortly after he became president and saying, we're not going to release the tax returns.
And, you know, that's true. You get down to it. And the fact is, he always returns to the idea that voters knew that he was an international businessman. He has very complex dealings, and he was elected. So his argument is these other rules may have applied to presidents in the past, but he has a different situation and voters signed off on it. So his argument is that he really doesn't have to follow these typical ethical rules because people knew what they were buying and they bought it.
That's Marilyn Giewax, NPR senior business editor, and we'll link you to more of Trump's Ethics Monitor at hereandnow.org. Marilyn, thanks.
Oh, you're welcome.
Kurt Cobain, the leader of the band Nirvana, would have turned 50 years old today. Nirvana skyrocketed to fame with this 1991 hit song, Smells Like Teen Spirit, but Cobain struggled with stardom and drug abuse. He killed himself on April 5, 1994. Journalist Charles Cross covered Cobain for the Seattle magazine The Rocket, which was the first publication to put Nirvana on its cover. Eventually, Cross wrote Heavier Than Heaven, a biography of the band, and in 2014 he published another book called Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. When we spoke, I asked Charles Cross why he felt it was necessary to write a second book about Cobain.
Well, Heavier Than Heaven is a straight-on biography where it's written in the third person and I do not insert myself as a narrator at all. That book ends essentially with Kurt's death in 1994, and a lot has happened since he has died. And his impact on music and on culture we can see with a much wider lens now. I felt like there were certain things that I kind of wanted to get off my chest, and I wanted to tell the story in a first-person way. And so this book is kind of more like a conversation with me. It's some of the topics that I feel are very important about Kurt's legacy: addiction, suicide, music, fashion, and how he changed the perception of Seattle. I think I guess felt impassioned that I somehow had more to say.
And we want to talk about all of those things. But first of all, let's get to his musical impact. What do you think it has been 20 years now after his death?
Well, it's truly an extraordinary impact. I think it's greater than anyone would have imagined 20 years ago. To some degree, that's affected by technological change. Nirvana's impact, both in terms of the sales of their albums, somewhere around 35 million albums sold. We haven't seen a rock group have that kind of huge mass cultural impact since Kurt died, partially because there hasn't been someone else to follow them. I think their legacy has been somewhat increased. But I also think that their greatest legacy is simply those songs. Those songs have such meaning to so many people. And when we talk about Kurt and why he mattered, that is by far and away the reason that he mattered, is that that body of songs that he created and wrote still speak to listeners today, both listeners that heard it in the 90s and people that are just discovering it now. That is an incredible body of work, and it's the reason that we still talk about him.
You write that Kurt had both everything and nothing to do with the term grunge, which we associate with these bands that came out of the Pacific Northwest. What do you mean by that?
He hated the word grunge, and pretty much everyone in Seattle hated the word grunge. And the reason was that grunge was kind of a journalistic laziness to describe all the music that came out of here. And if we just take Nirvana, for example, and we compare some of their music to Pearl Jam, there's so many differences. And though there are squealing guitars here and there, they aren't even really playing exactly the same genre of music. Yet, to everybody in the world, suddenly it all became grunge. And then you throw in Alice in Chains and Soundgarden, who had both more metal influences. It just was not really a fair term to describe everyone from our region as grunge. So Kurt hated it, musicians hated it, but to some degree it couldn't be stopped. It was the name that defined that music, it defined that generation, and it went on crazily to also even define fashion and a number of other things. Grunge has had a life in fashion that goes far beyond the life it has had in music.
Okay, let's talk about Kurt Cobain's impact on fashion. This is not something that I thought much about before reading your book, but he really was a fashion statement in the way that he dressed, and there are certain things about what he did that not only made a big splash back then, but are still big in the fashion world today.
Well, it's truly amazing because there has never been a fashion icon who put so little effort into their appearance and yet sold so many clothes at such a high price tag later on in his life. So Kurt wore flannel shirts, which he bought from Army-Navy stores for $5 or from thrift shops. And the reason he wore that is that's what people in Aberdeen and the Pacific Northwest wear because it's freezing for a lot of the year. And those designs eventually were co-opted by some of the hottest, you know, fashion designers, including Marc Jacobs, and were touted on fashion runways at $400 a pop. And they still are. Even this last year, there were a couple fashion designers who debuted what they called their grunge collection. So what's really remarkable is that grunge to most people in music means a certain time. It means the 90s. But in fashion today, if you went to Nordstrom.com and typed the word in grunge, you would find a half dozen outfits or styles that are described as grunge with current fashion.
Well, let's talk about another part of his legacy, his struggle with depression and substance abuse. He committed suicide, as we said, in April of 1994. And a few days after that, his widow, Courtney Love, recorded a message for his fans that was played during a vigil. Here she is reading his suicide note.
Sometimes I feel as I should have a punch-in time clock before I walk out on stage. I've tried everything within my power to appreciate it, and I do. God, believe me, I do, but it's not enough.
Charles Cross, you say that that event turned into brilliant public health policy. Why?
And rarely is it that the words Courtney Love and brilliant public health policy appear anywhere near each other. But in some strange way, that outpouring of emotion that you heard from Courtney and that you also felt in the crowd, and I was among the 10,000 there, there was such anger. It took away the romanticism of suicide. When Marilyn Monroe had died earlier with pills, it had sort of been romanticized by the press. But because Kurt's choice of suicide was so violent, so final, and frankly, because we got to actually hear his words, and everyone in the crowd at one point screamed a giant F you to Kurt. Courtney asked everyone to do that. There was this kind of collective unconscious primal scream that gave us a chance to kind of go through that emotion. And it took away that kind of English mysticism, romanticism of suicide. We got to see the face and hear the words of a person that had lost her husband. And I think it changed the way people thought about his suicide.
You think it kept people from committing suicide, other people?
Well, shockingly, the theory had always been that Kurt's death had, you know, set off a number of copycat suicides. For this book, the main new research that I was able to kind of break was that I interviewed some of the people who actually study suicide. And they extensively researched Kurt's suicide, both in the United States and in Australia. And they looked at suicide rates and found that they either stayed even or went down slightly in the wake of Kurt's death. Unfortunately, that statistic has eked up over time, and suicide remains an epidemic throughout the world and certainly in the United States. But Kurt Cobain's death, in some weird way that almost seems impossible to imagine, may have actually stopped some people from committing suicide more than what we thought, that it would send a wave of copycat suicides.
As you were, as I want you to be, yeah.
we're talking about him in a way in the abstract here. You, of course, knew him. You were a fan. What impact did he have, or does he continue to have, on you personally?
Well, the music certainly impacted me. It was part of my life. The magazine that I edited, The Rocket, Kurt was also our customer. He advertised in The Rocket several times looking for drummers. So when we lost him, we really felt like we lost part of Seattle's soul, frankly. You know, Kurt Cobain is owned by the world, but Seattle, even though he only lived here for 18 months of his life, ironically, we feel that he is ours and we are his to some degree. These songs are so much the fabric of my life, and I think so much the fabric of every music fan in Seattle's life, that when we talk about his legacy, it's also to some degree our legacy, our youths. It was the one time where it suddenly felt to everybody here that the world could go on its end. We're talking in the offices of KUOW in Seattle. In the basement of this building, Nirvana played. So I'm 50 feet away from where this band played one of their very first Seattle gigs. So it really is a huge part of Seattle's historical legacy and part of our culture.
Charles Cross talking about his book, Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. We spoke in 2014, and today would have been Cobain's 50th birthday. What else should I be?
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week. Change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/here. Go now and get your first three meals free, plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
Powerful storms inundated California over the weekend, leaving mudslides, sinkholes, and downed power lines in their wake. After enduring years of an historic drought, residents across the state are now preparing for severe flooding. For more, we're joined by John Sepulveda of KQED Radio. John, tell us which areas are worst hit and what's the damage like?
The worst hit areas so far actually have been in Southern California. We've seen five people die because of these storms that have come through. Just basically dumped a ton of rain, which when it happens in California, that means that there's a lot of earth that could move due to landslides, mudslides, things like that. Mm-hmm. And what you mentioned sinkholes, and that's absolutely right. In fact, it looked like something from some type of science fiction movie because people were parking their cars on the street and these sinkholes due to, you know, kind of the vacuous air that was underneath and pushed down from this water just swallowed cars, these parked cars in Southern California. It's been pretty amazing to watch. So that's what we've seen in Southern California. But now as we're turning into the week, we're seeing that what they call an atmospheric river that is a lot of people might know it as the Pineapple Express, as it's colloquially known, is pushing a ton of water into San Francisco, Sacramento. That area between San Francisco and Sacramento is supposed to get just drenched. And we're actually very concerned about what could happen in California's Central Valley.
So the state is not through the worst of it, John. How is the rest of the state preparing for this next wave?
Well, right now what we're seeing is individuals really begin to pack up and move. Now, your listeners might remember that last week, Lake Oroville, the state's second largest reservoir, had to evacuate about 180,000 people in the area because of concerns about the spillway. So what we're seeing now is people are taking preemptive measures to make sure that if they're told to leave, not just in Lake Oroville, which they're still concerned about that, but in other parts of the state, including in Stanislaus County, which is where Modesto's at, there's concern that a lake might overflow there, might go over the levee. And we're concerned about other levees and dams. You know, one of the things that happens in California is because not a lot of water falls in Southern California, we see a lot of it redirected from the north, and we're concerned that these levees and channels and things like that could overflow very quickly. So we're starting to see a lot of people take preemptive action.
John, you mentioned these monster sinkholes on roads and highways. What are authorities telling people to do? Stay in their homes during the storm? Update their earthquake kits for flooding? What?
all of that. You know, they've made it really clear that don't leave animals or children in cars. Not that that's happened, but, you know, these sinkholes have happened so quickly. They've happened so rapidly that if somebody's in the car, they might not have a chance to get out. And of course, when the sinkhole happens, it's because of soft ground, this vacuous ground. So, you know, people could actually get stuck in the sinkhole.
John, briefly, when is this rain scheduled to end?
The storms are looking like they're going to go all week. About 6 to 10 inches more rain could fall from San Francisco eastward. Or we're seeing the National Weather Service begin to issue advisories that this could actually go until Sunday and leave up to 16 inches of rain.
Reporter John Sepulveda with KQED in San Francisco. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
California bracing for more water problems. We'll be watching them all week.
Have you ever had a truffle, maybe a white truffle risotto or some scallops with black truffle sauce? If not, better start saving. Truffles are a delicious but very expensive kind of fungi, as our next guest knows well. His name is Ian Perkiastha, and he's the creator and owner of Regalis Foods. He's been importing truffles since he was a teenager. His new book is Truffle Boy, My Unexpected Journey Through the Exotic Food Underground, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And we should say, by the way, you're 24 years old right now.
I am.
You are. And how did you get into truffles as such a young person growing up in Fayetteville, Arkansas?
Well, my family actually relocated from Houston, Texas to rural Arkansas when I was 15. And the move to Arkansas was really to pursue a simpler lifestyle. My uncle and his family were living in Arkansas, and I started spending a lot of time with my uncle, who is an avid outdoorsman, and he showed me how to mushroom forage. So the first few mushrooms he showed me how to forage for were morels and chanterelles and black trumpets. And I had always loved cooking and eating well, and so I kind of became obsessed with all things mushroom-related. And I knew that truffles were regarded as the king of all mushrooms. And so on a visiting trip to Houston, I was fortunate enough to go to dinner with some of our old affluent friends from Houston, and they told me that I could order anything on the menu. And I saw this black truffle ravioli dish with a foie gras sauce, and so I ordered it. And from the very moment I tasted it, it was this amazing, unusual, earthy flavor, and I just became totally obsessed. And so when I returned to Arkansas, I begged my parents to give in to buy me a truffle or two, and their immediate reaction was, of course not, because Fayetteville was kind of our reset at all things lavish and fancy. And so I decided to pool together my savings from several Christmases in hopes of buying my first shipment of truffles.
And selling them to some of the restaurants in the area. I was wondering because, you know, when you go out to dinner, even in some of the biggest cities in this country, at some of the fanciest restaurants, it's still sometimes hard to find a place that has truffles on the menu. But you were able to find a number of places in Fayetteville or around Fayetteville that wanted to buy your truffles.
Yes. So the minimum was actually a kilo of truffles. And so my original intention was not to sell them, but to just buy a few truffles to eat, you know, for personal consumption. And so I found this French company in France that was willing to send me a kilo of truffle. And when they arrived, I realized there's actually quite a lot of truffles here. And that's when I decided, why not try to sell a portion of these to some local restaurants? So I cold called the three best restaurants in town, and my dad drove me, and I stopped at Target along the way picking up a little kitchen scale, and I basically just pretended like I was making a delivery and showed up to the chef and said, oh, I have, you know, these truffles from France. Would you like, you know, to buy a few? And so
how do you convince somebody to buy truffles from you when you're – how old at this point?
So I was 15.
15, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a simpler process than you might think. I just showed up and said, you know, I've got these truffles. Do you care to take a look? And I don't know if it was the novelty of this young buck-tooth kid walking in with truffles or the quality of the truffles themselves that completed the sale. But I had fun with it, and I turned a profit, and I just kept reinvesting and reinvesting into larger and larger orders. And my parents would take turns driving me to local larger cities, and I would hop out and cold call and cold call, and I established this little company in Arkansas, and I turned my parents' garage into a shipping center, and I would go to the airport after school several days a week to go pick up the truffles that had arrived, and I would make sales in between classes.
Did your teachers notice that you were doing this work while you were in class? You talk about in this book, sitting with your iPhone under your desk making deals.
Well, we had like a no-tolerance policy with cell phones. So if I was caught, it would be taken and I couldn't get it back until the end of the day. And then I think the second offense was not getting it back for a week or something. So I had to be pretty careful when making the sales. And so I eventually was having issues with quality. And so I started looking online for another source. And that's when I found an Italian company that was looking for U.S. representation. And I sent them an email and they were based in Italy. And I was, of course, based in Arkansas, and they were going to be in New York for the annual Fancy Food Show, which is one of the main trade events of the specialty food industry that summer. And I was also going to be in New York that summer looking at different colleges. And so we decided to meet in New York. And I remember they asked if I could meet for a beer. And I said, oh, sure, I'll meet, for a beer. And so I ordered a ginger beer in hopes that they wouldn't realize I was underage. And it worked. And we had this great conversation, and they decided to offer me this job to sell truffles for them. And so my job was to find all the customers, and their job was to provide the truffles. And so senior year is when I started working for them full time, in between classes and after school. And I told my parents after graduation that I was moving to New York to strike it big in the truffle business, to do this in the big leagues.
A lot of people may wonder how you, as a young man and even as a boy, I mean, you call yourself Truffle Boy on the cover of this book, had the ability to determine what was a good truffle and what was a bad truffle. Is there something about your sense of smell or taste that helped you, do well at this job?
Well, everything I've learned in these 9 years has been self-taught. That's not to say I've had a lot of help along the way in terms of meeting so many amazing people in this industry. But I have always loved cooking, and I grew up cooking with my grandfather and my mother, and entertaining and cooking for people was always such a strong importance. And so I've just applied that same passion for food to truffles.
What is the difference between a black truffle and a white truffle?
The two main differences, other than being different varieties entirely, is that they come into season at a different time. The white truffle from October through December in the fall, and the black truffle, or the winter black at least, between December and March. They have a very different aroma altogether. The white truffle is a very garlicky, kind of cheesy aroma. A black truffle smells more earthy, almost cognac-y, with this just very intoxicating, dark, musk. But I've heard everything from white truffles smell like marijuana and Italian sausage to, garlic and cheese and so forth. So it's very hard to describe.
And you write that there's now a little bit of change in the market because of truffles coming from China.
Well, the Chinese have their own indigenous variety. Everyone that sells truffles goes by the Latin name of the truffle variety. So the white truffle is tuber magnatum, and the black winter that everyone is familiar with is tuber melanosporum. And the Chinese truffle has its own Latin name, tuber indicum, and it looks identical to the famed winter black truffle.
But it's not
truffles,
as good.
It's not as good because it actually has no natural aroma. And so what companies will do is they'll mix these Chinese truffles in with the winter black truffles, and truffles give off this very intense aroma. And so they'll perfume the skin of the Chinese truffle, and at first glance, it'll look and smell like the real thing. But only after a day or two will the smell fade, and you realize you have this bland truffle look-alike.
Which brings us to another point that you make in this book, which is that the truffle business is kind of shady.
It is. It totally is shady. And I think part of the success that I've been so lucky to have with my company and my reputation is that I'm very transparent about all the ingredients that we sell. What I'm trying to do with Truffle Boy is to also demystify these once very underground, luxe ingredients that had these snobby reputations, and be as educated as possible, and also try to just make these ingredients a little bit more approachable for a younger generation.
So if somebody out there is listening and they've never had a truffle and they never thought that they should spend the money on getting truffles at some fancy restaurant, what would you tell them?
Well, I would say if someone is wanting to try an ingredient that literally smells like nothing else they've ever had, then the truffle is the ingredient for them. And truffles have been, you know, lustful and highly regarded for centuries for having this intoxicating aroma and flavor. So I would definitely encourage interested, adventuresome eaters to seek out truffles.
That's Ian Perkiasta, who is the author of the new book, Truffle Boy, My Unexpected Journey Through the Exotic Food Underground. He's also the creator and owner of Regalis Foods. Ian, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
In most White Houses, it's the job of ambassadors, State Department officials, and designated special envoys to negotiate peace deals. Today's New York Times indicates that diplomacy might be different in the Trump White House. The Times reports that President Trump's personal lawyer and a former Trump business associate met privately in New York City last month to negotiate a deal they hoped would lead to peace in Ukraine and the dropping of U.S. sanctions on Russia. The proposal comes amid growing scrutiny of Trump's pre-election contacts with Russia and Russian hacking of the U.S. election. Scott Shane is the New York Times reporter based in Washington who's covering the story, and he's a former Moscow correspondent. Scott, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me on, Eric.
First, before we get to the details of this back channel plan, give us a little sketch of the main players who met in New York to talk over this Ukraine plan.
Well, the person who brought the plan to the United States, to Washington and New York, his name is Andrei Artemenko, and he's a member of the Ukrainian parliament in the opposition to the current president in Ukraine. He brought this plan to a former Trump business associate named Felix Sater, who's a Russian-American business person in New York for many years, and connected the Ukrainian Artemenko with Michael Cohen, who is President Trump's personal lawyer, not the White House counsel, but the lawyer who handles Trump's private affairs.
You report they met in New York. What's the end plan of this Ukraine proposal? How would they get to a peace deal?
This fellow, Andrei Artemenko, what he proposed was that Russia would withdraw all forces from eastern Ukraine, and there would be a vote of Ukrainians on a very long-term lease of Crimea to Russia, 50 years or maybe 100 years. And so I think he saw that as a possible way to sort of split the baby and satisfy both sides.
Do we know, Scott, if these players were asked to do this by someone in the Trump administration, or were they merely freelancing in a kind of foreign policy vacuum?
I think they were really freelancing. There's no evidence that they were asked to do this. But President Trump has repeatedly praised Russian President Vladimir Putin and expressed the desire for better relations between the U.S. and Russia. And the Ukraine conflict is the biggest obstacle to better relations. So in some ways, you know, it appears that these Trump associates were trying to help the president out by, you know, bringing to the White House a scheme that might, in principle, be a step towards settling this conflict, allowing President Trump to drop the sanctions on Russia and to, you know, develop these better relations that he's talked about.
Scott, as you report, there's nothing illegal about, you know, these unofficial efforts. But tell us why this freelance Ukraine peace deal might set off some alarms.
Well, I think there is a general concern and mystery in the sort of foreign policy and intelligence world in Washington about President Trump's, you know, oft expressed admiration for President Putin of Russia. And, you know, of course, the intelligence agencies concluded that Putin had ordered the hacking of Democratic targets in the election, in part in an attempt to tip the election to Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton. You know, when a plan like this comes along that is certainly viewed by the Ukrainian government as very hostile to the Ukrainian government, to the current Ukrainian government, and favorable to Russia, you know, there are alarm bells certainly in Ukraine and, you know, I think in the sort of foreign policy establishment in Washington as well. I should add that along with this peace plan, Mr. Artemenko, the Ukrainian lawmaker, promised a detailed file of what Russians and Ukrainians call kompromat, compromising material, on alleged corruption of the current Ukrainian president, perhaps with the idea that the current president would be replaced by a new president more favorable to Russia, and that that would allow this peace plan to go forward.
Scott, briefly, what response have you gotten to your story from the Trump administration and from the Kremlin?
Well, Mr. Cohen, after telling us that he had delivered the peace proposal to the White House, told the Washington Post last night that, in fact, he hadn't, that he'd received the peace proposal, but had not passed it on. So I'm not sure, you know, he was quite clear in telling us that he had passed it on, so I'm not sure what to make of that. And the White House, I think, is actually looking into that at the moment. The Kremlin, meanwhile, has said they are unaware of this peace plan. The Kremlin also said the plan made no sense because how could Russia lease its own territory, referring to Crimea? So the standoff between Ukraine and Russia over this territorial dispute continues.
Scott Chain is a New York Times correspondent based in Washington. He reports today on a back-channel plan for Ukraine. Scott, thanks very much.
Thank you.